Oreo Christus. We heard the voices of Benita Valente, Mariana Lipovšek, Peter Lindros and Tom Krauser with the Slovak Philharmonic Choir and the Rotterdam Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by James Conlon. From waves of sound on an epic scale to music inhabiting the frontiers of silence in Liszt's late works. Join me, if you can, tomorrow.
Donald MacLeod. This is BBC Radio 3, and now it's time to go live to the Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. It's presented by Susie Klein.
Thanks very much, and good evening to you. So, the players of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales have had no rest at all since their appearance here last night. Then it was a programme of French favourites. Now they're back, with principal conductor Thierry Fischer bringing us Beethoven. Two symphonies, each packed to the brim with swagger and self-confidence. The First Symphony and the Seventh. Sitting between those two, a pair of flute concertos, written for tonight's soloist, one of the world's great players, the flautist Emmanuel Pahud, is here with two contemporary pieces, concertos for the 21st century, from Elliot Carter and Marc-André Dalbavy. We kick off tonight with Beethoven 1, written in the wake of both Haydn and Mozart's final symphonies. Beethoven began work on the piece, well, we're not quite sure when, sometime around 1795. His intention to announce to the Viennese public that his teacher Haydn, his hero Mozart, were both now gone. He was the new young gun in town. And so Beethoven put on one of the vast concerts that were to become his trademark, an evening in Vienna's Burgtheater, including the premieres of a new septet and the second piano concerto. The concert had the desired effect, the First Symphony in particular, announcing that this was a new talent on the music scene, tough, uncompromisingly individual, classical and elegant. So the leader of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, Leslie Hatfield, along with all of the players of the orchestra, in position on stage, joined now by Thierry Fischer to open tonight's concert with Beethoven's First Symphony. young man's music indeed, full of wit, vim and vigour. Beethoven's First Symphony, premiered Vienna 1800, part of an epic concert announcing to the world that this composer had arrived. A live performance at the 2011 BBC Proms by Thierry Fisher and the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, their leader tonight, Leslie Hatfield. Opening this, the third of five proms that this orchestra is giving this season. Well, on now to the next piece on this evening's programme, and it's the first of those two flute concertos receiving its London premiere, Marc-André Dalbavy's Flute Concerto, a piece that's been described as opulent, tender, squarely in the French tradition. Dalbavy was born in 1961, and he's emerged as one of the leading French composers of his generation. He's gained international recognition for his unusual combinations of instrumental timbres, his music always concerned with the movement of sound through space. Well, I met up with Dalbavy earlier today, along with the soloist Emmanuel Payou, who began by telling me what attracted him to Dalbavy's music.
Marc-André is certainly the best ambassador of eminently French musical language. As you can hear in the flute concerto, actually, there's lots of bits in there that do refer to what has been written in musical history in France. And I think this is the signature of the great, is that you instantly recognize the origin, where that music comes from, and where, in a way, it's going also.
I must say that I didn't have the idea to write a flute concerto in my life, because I'm closer to piano or to violin, and flute was for me an instrument which I use as an instrument of the orchestra, so it was not at all my topics. And I really did this concerto because Emmanuel was the player. So there are a lot of pieces that I do because I have an artistic project, but there are a lot of pieces that I do because there is a relation with an artist, like a theater writer who writes something for an actress or an actor. And this piece is really written for Emmanuel. But for me, it was evident that I didn't want to have a full symphonic orchestra with the flute, because I really wanted to have a sort of continuity between the sound of the orchestra and the solo flute.
So you're Marc-André Dalbavy, whose flute concerto receives its London premiere here at the Proms tonight, the soloist Emmanuel Payou. And here he is walking out onto the platform with principal conductor of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, Thierry Fisher, for Marc-André Dalbavy's flute concerto.
Thank you.
Emmanuel Pahu, the soloist Thierry Fisher, and the BBC National Orchestra of Wales giving the London premiere of Marc-André Dalbavy's Flute Concerto. I must mention also Chris Stock, who had that fiendishly crazy xylophone part towards the end there, but such a virtuoso piece for everybody involved, eye-wateringly so. Here's the composer himself, warm embraces for Emmanuel Pahu and Thierry Fisher from Marc-André Dalbavy. A man with such incredible reverence, I think, for the traditions of French music. Little flashes of Debussy there, Stravinsky, Boulez. He apparently locks himself away to write in a 15th century farmhouse in the French countryside. Well, why not? He says, I'm completely alone, every door's shut, the windows too. I work every day in this atelier in a sort of isolation world. He's a busy man too. Forthcoming ballet for New York City Ballet, also an opera, an adaptation of the novel, The Time of Our Singing. That's for Salzburg Festival. And Emmanuel Pahu leading the march back onto stage here at the Royal Albert Hall. He is such a sensational player to watch live. I've heard so many of his recordings, but it is just a privilege to watch him. The virtuosity is so all-encompassing and the musicality is just there. And he loves what he does. It's so apparent. He'll be back, of course, for more in the second half of tonight's concert with Elliot Carter's Flute Concerto. So it's time now for the interval before that second half still to come. One of the fruits of the late flowering of Elliot Carter's career, piece written when he was just 99 years old, that Flute Concerto still to come, receiving its UK premiere here tonight. Also the last ever work to be conducted by the Proms founder himself, Sir Henry Wood, before his death. It's Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, here at the Proms in 2011. Before that, it's time for our interval feature, as the writer Ian Sansom goes in search of a nice pair of hand-stitched English shoes.
In 1886, so the story goes, Van Gogh visited a Paris flea market where he came across a pair of dismal, worn-out shoes, the kind of shoes Charlie Chaplin famously boils up and eats in the film The Gold Rush, charity shop shoes, car boot sale shoes, shoes just one short step from total disintegration. Van Gogh bought the shoes, took them home, and as befits a painter, he painted them. For those following this talk, beslippered from the comfort of their own substantial private library, the painting is number 225 in Delafaye's catalogue of Van Gogh's work. For those without a library, but with access to the internet, simply type Van Gogh and shoes into Google Images, where you'll find several pairs to choose from. Van Gogh was the post-impressionist Imelda Marcos, collecting and painting more than half a dozen pairs during his lifetime. The 1886 flea market shoes are the black and mismatched-looking pair with the background bathed in gold. Van Gogh's a pair of shoes might be kept in a box marked Pathos. In 1930, the philosopher Martin Heidegger saw Van Gogh's painting at an exhibition in Amsterdam and subsequently wrote about it in his book The Origin of the Work of Art, first published in 1935. From the dark opening of the worn insides of the shoes, writes Heidegger, the toilsome tread of the worker stares forth. In the stiffly rugged heaviness of the shoes, there is the accumulated tenacity of her slow trudge through the far-spreading and ever-uniform furrows of the field, swept by a raw wind. On the leather lie the dampness and richness of the soil. Under the soles slides the loneliness of the field path as evening falls. In the shoes vibrates the silent cool of the earth, its quiet gift of the ripening grain and its unexplained self-refusal in the fallow desolation of the wintry field. The shoes demonstrate what Heidegger calls, in typically riddling Heidegger speak, the equipmentality of equipment
the resting within itself of the true art object, the being of the being. The shoes are a demonstration, in other words, a disclosure of a truth about the world. Heidegger's Fantasia on Van Gogh's shoes, which has itself inspired further fancies and capriccios on boots and shoes by the likes of Jacques Derrida and Frederick Jameson, remains perhaps the most famous philosophical engagement with footwear, though it is not perhaps, it should be said, the most accurate. In an essay published in 1968, The Still Life as a Personal Object, the art historian Maya Shapiro pointed out that the shoes in Van Gogh's painting are not women's shoes, as Heidegger blithely assumes, nor indeed are they peasant shoes of any kind. They are in fact city shoes, according to Shapiro, and moreover, the shoes of the artist, and certainly do not therefore express the being or essence of a peasant woman's shoes and her relation to nature and work. On the contrary, argues Shapiro, the shoes are a portrait or a symbol of Van Gogh's own personality and struggles, telling the story of his own journeyings and adversities. So, shoes either as exemplary art objects, things in and of themselves, or as intimate portraits of the self. We shall try on both possibilities for size. We shall also be tried for size at Carré Ducker, bespoke shoemaking company in Cockpit Yard, right in the heart of literary Bloomsbury. The father of English literature, Geoffrey Chaucer, it may be interesting to note, may have come from shoemaking stock. His name derives from the French chausseur, which means shoemaker. Christopher Marlowe was a shoemaker's son, Thomas Traherne, and one of the great English poets and critics was almost lost forever to the shoemaking trade. It was apparently, according to his biographers, a young Samuel Taylor Coleridge's desire to be apprenticed to a shoemaker who lived near his school. The shoemaker duly approached the headmaster of the school, who promptly turned the man away. So it remains a matter of speculation what the author of the Biographia Literaria would have made of a career in boots and leather. I have never met an actual real live shoemaker, a cordwainer, before. The word derives from the French term cordonnier, which is itself derived from the name of the Spanish city of Cordoba, home of the leather known as cordovan. And I fear I may have unrealistic expectations.
Okay.
Yeah, so if you'd like to stand up and put your feet on the paper.
Apollo, god of the arts, was the deity of the shoemakers of Greece and Rome. At the entrance to Sandalarium Vicus, Sandal Street, Emperor Augustus placed a statue of Apollo, and in memory of Apollo, shoemakers traditionally wore their hair long, had flowing beards tucked into their aprons, and looked, if not like gods, then at least like holy men or sages. Mr. Ducker has a neatly trimmed beard.
I can see you've got fairly flat feet, but that's not an uncommon...
Ms. Carré has long hair swept up.
So we take three measurements across the breadth of the foot, across two across the joint at the widest points. And then
the first thing that God asks Moses to do when they meet on Mount Sinai is to take off his shoes, just like your mother used to when you invited friends round from school and you'd been playing outside and wanted to go upstairs. In Exodus chapter 3 verse 5, Moses is commanded, "Draw not nigh hither, put off thy shoes from off thy feet, for the place whereon thou standest is holy ground," or a Cyril Lord carpet. On the eve of their journey out of Egypt, the ancient Israelites are told to be prepared with your shoes on your feet and your staff in your hand. And somehow, miraculously, these same shoes did not wear out in the 40 years they spent in the wilderness. Unlike my children's school shoes, which usually fall apart completely by the end of the first term, and which often have the appearance of having been ravaged by wild dogs. The lesson for the Israelites was to trust in God and to keep his laws. The lesson for me is not to shop in cheap shoe shops. Earth's crammed with heaven, according to Elizabeth Barrett Browning in her epic verse novel Aurora Leigh, and every common bush afire with God, but only he who sees takes off his shoes. In many religious traditions, not only in Judaism or in Christianity, there is an association between barefootedness, holiness, and holy ground. Muslims remove their shoes in devotional spaces, Hindus similarly, and so, naturally, as a corollary, in many cultures, shoes have come to be regarded as impure, as polluted objects. You may remember the sight of protesters in Tahrir Square back in February, waving their shoes en masse in disgust in response to speeches by Husni Mubarak. For a moment, from a distance, the Arab Spring looked like an angry queue at a cobbler's. George Papandreou, Tony Blair, Wen Jiabao and Pervez Musharraf have all in recent years had shoes thrown at them in protest. Shoeing, as it is called, is in one form or another an ancient and venerable tradition. The ancient Egyptians were said to paint on the soles of their sandals the figure of an enemy so that they might daily crush them underfoot. Similarly, in the Jewish celebration of Purim, feet are stomped at the mention of Haman, the arch-enemy, whose name should be obliterated from memory, and according to a report in the Daily Telegraph, after the first Gulf War, a mosaic of the face of George Bush Sr. was laid on the floor of the Al-Rashid Hotel in Baghdad so that anyone entering the lobby had to walk all over him. Impure shoes, naturally and perversely, also become objects of fascination, or indeed fetishism, as forbidden or transgressive objects representing or even containing the devil and all his works. Kraft Ebbing may have been the first to make clear the connection between shoe fetishism and masochism, but where Kraft Ebbing first trod, so thousands of cultural theorists have since followed. Susan Brownmiller, for example, in her book Femininity, compares the leather straps and hobbling heels of women's shoes with the restraining leg irons and ankle chains endured by captive animals, prisoners and slaves, who were also festooned with decorated symbols of their bondage. Wags in their heels are as chattels. The emancipated Manhattanites of Sex and the City, striding around in their Manolo Blahniks, were no better than slaves. There is an English medieval legend of Sir John Shorn, the rector of North Marston in Buckinghamshire, who craftily conjured the devil into captivity in a boot. Alas, according to the legend, when the good reverend died, the devil escaped the boot and so is abroad and about his business once more. One thinks perhaps of Christian Louboutin's signature red soles, the devil's tongue lapping at the heels of the wearer, or of Moira Shearer in Powell and Pressburger's The Red Shoes, based on the Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale, tormented and ultimately doomed by her blazing red shoes and her desire to dance. Shoes in fairy tales, one hardly needs a semiotician to point out, often represent awakening desire and symbolise the transition between childhood and adult sexual maturity. They also, usefully, allow one to fly, to be invisible and to cover long distances. Shoes work magic. They transform. We all want to be Dorothy. There are Egyptian sandals in the British Museum of the most exquisite white leather with intricate tooled ornamentation. The funeral effigy of Henry III in Westminster Abbey has him in a gorgeous pair of slip-ons decorated with lions. Under the reign of Henry VII, we know that there was a fashion for two horned shoes and duck-billed toes. The Cavaliers had their fancy boots, the Georgians their shiny buckles, and Queen Victoria, ever the trendsetter, was one of the first to wear the newfangled elastic-sided boots in a style later much favoured by mods and Star Wars stormtroopers. The 1554 inventory for Queen Mary Tudor list payments for no fewer than 38 pairs of velvet shoes lined with satin, 2 pairs of buskins, and 3 pairs of velvet slippers. An inventory of my own shoes currently runs to 1 pair of black plastic Crocs, an unwanted Christmas gift, 1 pair of super stout bulbous-nosed brogues, brown, bought in a camping shop in Norfolk, and 1 pair of slightly too shiny, sharp-pointed brogues, black, bought in a sale from Reed's Shoe Shop on Sandy Row in Belfast. I have, over the years, tried most shoe styles: Chelsea boots, desert boots, brothel creepers, Dr. Martens, a pair of ill-advised winkle pickers even, and cannot explain successfully, even to myself, my increasing tendency towards brogues, except perhaps to suggest that simply, with the passing of time, all men drift towards brogues and their combination of rugged practicality with just a hint of ornamentation, though the ornament, it should be noted, like much apparent ornament, derives originally from practical purpose. The patterns of ornate punctures on brogues are claimed by several authorities to derive from the habit of the Scots to gash their shoes so that water could gush out when they had crossed a river. I am not much in the habit of fording rivers myself, but one never knows. Perhaps my workaday brogues are deep down an expression of my desire for exotic adventure.
Are you thinking of a shoe or a boot?
I might be inclined towards a boot.
Okay.
Now we've come all this way.
No, I mean, I personally don't like boots because I don't like the way they feel on my ankle, but I mean, it's a personal choice.
I love boots. I think more men should wear boots because they look so elegant at the end of a leg. If you wear a shoe and you get the bottom of your trouser leg, your trouser cuff caught up on it, it looks dreadful. So I think boots are the solution to the aesthetics.
Someone called Catherine Eisman published a book a few years ago, How to Tell a Man by His Shoes, in which she claimed to be able to fulfil the promise of her title and to be able to analyse a man's entire personality merely by the shoes he wears, shoes rather than eyes as windows to the soul. Eisman's insights into male personality types extend as far as Gucci shoe man, 10-pin bowling shoe man, and raised platform shoe man, but her typology, alas, does not include unwanted gift of Crocs man or worn-out brown bulbous brogues man, let alone Paris flea market second-hand shoe man or tartar boot man or yellow Turkish slipper man or traditional Serbian apansi shoe man or boots of Spanish leather embroidered all in gold man, all of which might present a real challenge to the professional and amateur psychologist alike. It seems pretty obvious, frankly, that someone who wears raised platform shoes is someone who wants to look taller. But what is it I want, and who is it I am? If I am sporting, say, a pair of deep dark red shoes from Rangoon, made of the native leather tanned with mangrove bark, or a pair of imitation samurai boots made of iron, gilded metal, stencilled leather, and decorated with bear fur.
So with your derby boots, for instance, mixing the grain and the smooth surface box calf is quite a nice contrast to make.
Yes.
So you can have the saddle bit in the grain and then the rest in the smooth leather.
Oh, that would be, that really would be rather stylish, wouldn't it? I am that I am, perhaps, to go back to God and Moses on Mount Sinai. In his novel Hunger, Knut Hamsun's unnamed narrator describes his shoes as like a ghost of my other eye. And in his poem My Shoes, the great American poet Charles Simich speaks of shoes as the secret face of my inner life, which is literally as well as metaphorically true. Shoes bear our imprint. When I remove my shirt, my trousers and my jacket, I disappear from them. But my shoes take and keep my shape and suggest my presence. Shoes retain a likeness of myself, or at least of my feet. They leave human traces.
The other thing I'm going to do finally is take a firm impression of your feet. So this is like that stuff that they make flower arrangements with. So you're going to stand
on that.
Just stand in there.
Stand in it. Just straight
don't
away.
Move, as you... Don't move once you're in.
Yeah.
Just
okay.
Plant firmly and
okay.
Go for it.
That's it. That really crunched.
Yes.
That's like standing in a bowl of a Weetabix, isn't it? Right.
There you go. Right, you can step out now. So there you go, that's your feet.
Wow. It's a rather spooky trace of the human, isn't it?
It really emphasises, I think, that there's something about the sort of the humanity of it, the fact that your feet are the things that are grounding you to the earth, and actually looking at those, you just kind of go, you know, you can see the weight, you can see gravity, you can see sort of so much kind of going on.
Which is why they function so successfully as memorials and as evidence. Ernest Hemingway famously claimed that his most successful short story consisted of just six words: for sale, baby shoes, never worn. At the trial of Adolf Eichmann in Jerusalem in 1961, the Israeli Attorney General, Gideon Hausner, produced a pair of children's shoes taken from the Treblinka concentration camp. They were an eloquent witness. The sight of stolen or abandoned or forgotten or single shoes can act as a powerful call to the ethical imagination. Hence, and alas, their important role in Holocaust memorial sites and museums. 80,000 pairs of shoes in the Auschwitz Museum and Memorial alone. Seeing and imagining ourselves in another person's shoes means having knowledge of their life, which of course is the very definition of empathy, the experience of another's experience. The philosopher Immanuel Levinas, in his book Totality and Infinity, writes about what he calls the epiphany of the face as the crucial sign or signal of the other, which might lead to a recognition of the demands and obligations of the other. Following Elvis, rather than Levinas, in the spirit of Elvis's extraordinary rendition of Joe Southern's hit Walk a Mile in My Shoes, we might speak in conclusion of the epiphany of the shoe. Walk a mile in my shoes, walk a mile in my shoes, before you abuse, criticise and accuse, walk a mile in my shoes. Plutarch, in his Lives, puts it another way. He tells the story of a Roman who decided to divorce his wife after many years of marriage. The Roman's friends were amazed. Is she not good looking, they asked? Has she not borne you five children? Is she not faithful? The good Roman pointed to his shoe. This is a presentable shoe, he said, but only the wearer can tell where it pinches.
Our prices start at £2,670, which includes VAT and shoe trees. And because you're having a boot, the price will be £2,790.
I'm glad that it includes the shoe trees.
And we should point out that no money actually changed hands in the pursuit of Ian Sansom's hypothetical exercise to find a nice pair of hand-stitched English shoes. The programme was produced in Bristol by Sarah Davis. Well, a very warm welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall in London from me, Susie Klein. We're live on Radio 3 for this evening's prom, given by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales under its principal conductor, Thierry Fischer. Still to come, more Beethoven, the Seventh Symphony. But next up, Emmanuel Pahud is back. The principal flute of the Berlin Phil will be giving the UK premiere of a flute concerto written for him by one of the most prolific and adventurous musicians of the last century, and of this one too. Elliot Carter remains as inventive, as individual, as uncompromising today as he ever was. His flute concerto was completed in 2008, when the composer was a mere 99 years old. Now, at the age of 102 and a half, he'll turn 103 this December, he's still writing, though not perhaps with the intensity and the pace that he was leading up to his centenary. But those short, pithy pieces keep on coming, and what Elliot Carter has to say still has the punch and impact that many a younger composer would envy. So too tonight's soloist, Emmanuel Pahud.
This person has been seeing so many things and a world in very different shapes. And I guess you hear all of this in this music. That is quite crystalline in a way. It's called concerto, but it's very short. It's 14 minutes, more or less. And it's rather a piece for flute and ensemble. You could even call it a nocturne in a certain way, because it fades out in the night. It starts crepitating a lot in the beginning, lots of notes that all leave an imprint in the orchestra, and therefore the layers add up, bringing up some harmonies that fade in and out. And these harmonies give the background for me to make a melodic line on top of this in the middle section, and then we have a competition in a way between the solo instrument and the orchestra, or the solo instruments from the orchestra throughout the piece, that ends up in an ending that's more like a question mark in a way, with a rhythm that's not square, that's all in five, and where nobody really knows where the downbeat is. And this is how it ends.
The flute repertoire, as you've said, is quite fulsome. So why is it so important to you to be at the heart of commissioning new work?
It's not only important, it just makes sense. I'm not there to deal with music from the past. I'm playing presently to an audience, giving 2 hours of their life in a concert in the evening, and we really wanted to make it worthwhile for everybody. And I think it's not by playing the great hits from the past only that we keep things moving on. And of course, the next generation will be able to tell us which pieces it was worthwhile commissioning, performing, and spending some time on. But this is not something I want to deal with. For me, the best music is the one I'm performing right now.
Emmanuel Pahud returning to the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall, accompanied by conductor Thierry Fischer and the UK premiere of Carter's Flute Concerto.
Thank you. Thank you.
Elliot Carter's Flute Concerto, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, and principal conductor Thierry Fisher. The leader of the orchestra tonight, Leslie Hatfield, and the soloist, the wonderful Emmanuel Pau, an outstanding ambassador for new music and also for flute playing. He was just 22 years old when he joined the Berlin Philharmonic. He was the youngest player, all the more remarkable, since he also went in as a top dog principal flute. Well, along with the UK premiere of Carter's Flute Concerto, which you just heard, you can also hear Pau play again at this year's Proms, one of our Proms Chamber Concerts, Monday the 22nd of August, 1 o'clock, live on BBC Radio 3, a programme of Martinu Dutier Prokofiev. They'll be joined for that by the pianist Eric Lesage. Also, all of this week on Classical Collections, Sarah Walker's been presenting a complete survey of Poe's recordings, music by Bach, Mozart, Debussy. Fantastic to get a sense of the range and quality of his work. You can listen again via the Radio 3 website. So, finally on the bill this evening, we're back to Beethoven. We've had the youthful confidence of his first symphony. Next, it's the seventh, written in the early 1810s, by which time Beethoven was a seriously established composer, without doubt the leading light in new music anywhere in Europe. He now faced a different kind of challenge from those early problems of recognition and acceptance by the establishment. Now it was a question of juggling the competing demands of fame, popularity, and artistic innovation. And he still faced an often dismissive public and bewildered critics. Sometimes the Viennese just didn't get his music. The Seventh Symphony, though, was an immediate success, seen as both artistically great and hugely popular. The piece's slow movement was often performed separately from the complete symphony, and it was, in his lifetime, perhaps Beethoven's most popular orchestral work. Well, earlier today, I asked tonight's conductor, Thierry Fisher, why he paired the first symphony, which opened this prom, with the seventh.
The idea was to show Beethoven in contrast in this concert. And I'm a big fan of early Beethoven symphonies, especially first and second. And I think what we liked very much was the fact that they are so different. It's very classical. It's almost late Haydn one, the first one. And you could almost say, to my view, that the seventh is written by another composer, because the idea of writing melodies is very different in the seventh than in the first one. Also, the structure, for example, in the third movement is much more developed, is less academic, like two trios, but the two trios are identical, and the three scherzos are shorter and shorter. So it's very strange ideas, which shows that the Beethoven journey in all his nine symphonies are just nine completely fascinating different stories. There is not one symphony same to the other.
What are the challenges of bringing music by somebody like Beethoven to an acoustic and a space of the size of the Royal Albert Hall?
Oh, this is quite a big challenge, because I do believe we have to adapt the string size of an orchestra to the hall we are performing. And here is not only so huge, but also that I know, having sat in the hall a few times, that depending where you sit, you hear just completely differently the orchestra. So I made the option to have a not too small and not too big orchestra. Not too big because it's not going with the style I want to give, the freshness and the energetic radical contrast I like in Beethoven. And not too small, that, you know, it's one thing to have a good idea, but it's another thing to make this idea going through to an audience. So we took sort of medium-sized orchestra for this, thinking only of the hall.
Thierry Fisher, principal conductor of the BBC National Orchestra of Wales. And a performance now of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony.
Thank you. Thank you.
The music of Beethoven opening and closing tonight's prom. Beethoven's 7th Symphony, a performance by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Thierry Fisher. Leading the orchestra tonight, Leslie Hatfield. That music first heard amid an atmosphere of long-awaited victory and freedom in Vienna. Napoleon's troops had been there for so long. Finally, they were about to leave, and that symphony was heard, exultant, jubilant. No mistake, I think, that the timpani in the final movement there sounds absolutely like cannon fire, the sound of celebration, but one that Viennese audiences must have been so familiar with. In rehearsals today, Thierry Fisher told Marnie O'Sullivan, the percussionist, "I want those timpani explosive and atomic." Well, this is the third of the orchestra's five proms this evening, given to, as you can hear, a packed and very enthusiastic crowd here at the Royal Albert Hall. The players back on the coach to Cardiff after tonight's concert, home to a well-deserved rest. They're back here in a couple of weeks with their charismatic associate guest conductor, François-Xavier Roth. French and English music then, including Saint-Saëns Organ Symphony, a new double concerto from Simon Holt. That's Tuesday, the 9th of August. You can hear this concert again. Just go to the Radio 3 homepage and find the iPlayer. Meanwhile, tomorrow evening here at the Royal Albert Hall, the always brilliant Oliver Nussen is here with the BBC Symphony Orchestra, a characteristically thought-provoking programme. Honegger, Bridge and Berg rubbing shoulders with Castiglione and Debussy. I'm back at the proms next Wednesday evening on BBC 4 television. But for now, it's been a pleasure to have had your company this evening. We're back to Broadcasting House and Jill Anderson.
Thank you very much. That was Susie Klein at the Royal Albert Hall. And there's another chance to hear tonight's prom on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock here on Radio 3. In about 25 minutes' time, Francis Burns visits two dance companies to investigate the legacy of the choreographers Merce Cunningham and Pina Bausch. That's at 9:45. And in the essay at 10:45, Ashutosh Khandekar recalls how his childhood in Bombay and student days in Britain led to a lifelong love of opera. Well, let's stay in the classical period until then with music by Beethoven's friend Louis Spohr. We'll hear an octet, not just for wind, as you might expect from the title, but for wind and strings. The scoring is for clarinet, two horns, violin, two violas, cello and double bass. And the third of the four movements is a set of variations on a theme by Handel from the harpsichord suite in E, the one called Harmonious Blacksmith. Well, here to play Spohr's Octet in E, Opus 32, are the Nash Ensemble.
Thank you.
In E, Opus 32, by Louis Spohr. It was played by the Nash Ensemble, Anthony Pay, clarinet, John Pinyegi and Anthony Halstead, horns, with Marcy Crayford, violin, Brian Hawkins and Kenneth Essex, violas, Christopher Van Kampen, cello, and Rodney Slatford, double bass. 2 summers ago, 2 important modern choreographers died, leaving dancegoers and dancers bereft, and their dance works hanging on a thread. A year on, last summer, Francis Burns visited the companies of both Pina Bausch and Merce Cunningham. Now, as the Merce Cunningham Dance Company is on its final tour, in this repeat of last year's programme, she asks, what happens to dances after dance makers die?
So these are the notes for Pictures, which was my first dance. Yeah.
Someone's reading a dance.
LIF walks, number 30. So Lise Friedman, those are her initials, is walking in, doing phrase number 30. AG, that's Alan Good, is walking at the same time as her. He's doing phrase number 21. I remember the piece so well. So phrase number 30 is a slow walk in releve fourth, and Alan's phrase was a walk on flat foot.
But this logbook of stick men and shorthand is a choreographer's notebook. It isn't the dance itself. No score or script can give us a dance.
I was the new person in the company at the time, so it would be a while. Here I am. PL, step on left.
Merce Cunningham said, you have to love dancing to stick to it. It gives you nothing back. No manuscripts to store away, no paintings to show on walls and maybe hang in museums, no poems to be printed and sold, nothing but that fleeting moment when you feel alive. Last summer, after 90 years of life, during which he'd made about 200 dances and been called a genius, he died in New York. The fleeting moment over, can his masterwork survive? Twenty-seven days before Merce, another seminal dancemaker had died, suddenly in Wuppertal, in Germany, Pina Bausch. I never considered going to see Merce Cunningham's grave in New York. There's something here that really suits Pina. A grave overlooking a pond in the woods, which is all smoky. And moving. And of course, beside me, her changing body. Both Merce Cunningham and Pina Bausch made original worlds out of movement. I'd say Merce was of the air and Pina of the earth. The work of Cunningham is like lines that light makes in water. Pina's dancers get drenched or quenched or reborn in it. Most dance works have been lost. Of course, flimsy things disintegrate, superficial works cloy, earnest things bore. But what about the most revelatory of our modern dancers? Surely dancegoers who thrive on a sense of possibility and loss, always in hope of the numinous moment, do want another few seasons of Biped, Summer Space, Beach Birds, Nelken, Bausch's Rite of Spring, before they join the long list of the lost or, like Nijinsky's Rite of Spring, myth.
Dance is an activity. Unless it's done, unless it's dealt with, it doesn't exist. Then it becomes a memory or a photograph or a videotape.
The most immediately bereaved are the dancers. Typically for pioneers of modern dance, both Cunningham and Bausch founded companies which were named after them and danced only their works. They first choreographed for their own bodies, and their dancers often seem cast in their likeness. So the death of these choreographers is a particular crisis.
Is everybody here?
On the notice board of the Cunningham Studios in Manhattan, I saw a list of rules by John Cage, Mercer's partner and collaborator. One rule says, always follow the leader.
All right, let's take places.
Robert Swinston is setting his watch to time a run-through.
All right, position.
He performed for Mercer for 30 years.
Go.
The last 17 of which he was also his assistant.
Curtain coming up.
Mercer's picture is up on the wall, and his desk is still there, and we have another picture of him there. We have plants and flowers there, and we light candles when we work. Of course, we miss him. You know, he was a leader. I'm very similar to him in a way. We call it studio rat, that we come to the studio every day. This is our home and where we work, the daily work. The process is really our life. It's our lifeblood. So I'm trying to figure out a way to maintain the Cunningham Studio, to teach Mercer's technique, and also to teach his repertory.
Close. Either first or fifth back. Do you remember what you did? Did you close fifth?
It feels like fifth, but I can't say.
I think so. Close fifth back and twist, holding the arms. Brush the left leg side with the arms going side high straight. Close fifth back.
To pass Mercer's work on to this generation and then the next generation, and hopefully then this generation who's learning it now can develop their experience and take it to the three or four generations forward. This is how you pass dance from one generation to the other.
Have you ever considered just letting the dance evaporate?
I never considered that. Of course, I'm devoted to his work. I mean, dance should be seen. Dance is a verb.
Pina Bausch forged theatre works out of material her dancers fed her, intimacies about trying to connect with each other and the world. She absorbed the dancers into her body, and they absorbed her.
Okay, quiet, please, we start.
Josephine Ann Endicott, who's Australian, joined Bausch's Wuppertal Tanztheater in 1973, the year it began.
You gave so much of yourself. You gave so many feelings to her. Sometimes I thought, I am her feelings. I've always wanted to leave that company, but now that she left us first, I've always wanted to have short hair. Not always, but over the last 10 years, because when you get over 50, people say old people shouldn't have long hair, but Pina wanted always Joe with long hair. I got a pair of scissors, and I took this part of my hair, the fringe, and started cutting. I had this in my hand, the tail of my handy rang. It was actually one of Pina's assistants, and the call was, Joe, Pina is dead. The scissors fell to the floor. I let the hair down, and I I couldn't cut any longer. So this, I don't know, it's a very bizarre connection to her through my hair. And I wanted to cut it, and I was one chop away, and then that phone rang. So it's something very bizarre. I thought to myself, oh, now I can be free of her. Now I can be free. And the next morning, I walked down to the beach, to the sea, and I started to swim into this big sea. And I started crying in the water and calling out, Pina, Pina.
Shall I bring you back to a very practical question?
Yeah.
Who inherited the dancers?
The rights and all of that has the son of Pina, Rolf Solomon Bausch.
And does that matter? Will that affect things?
No, I don't think so. He will try and do what he thinks is right and what's best for the company. I don't know, he's maybe 24. It's a very nice boy, man, now. Yeah, we are in his hands. They have a Stiftung, a foundation. We're seeing, we're going from week to week, from month to month, and learning by doing.
Pina died without a will. There were no formal plans in place for her succession. While her family will organise memory of her work, it's her dancers who embody it. And they're going to keep the company going. Dominique Mercy is now the Tanz Theatre's co-director.
I think we have the duty to keep her work alive. Because we are the one which still have it somehow in our blood and brain and spirit somehow, and it's very fragile.
In contrast, the Merce Cunningham Company is going to close. Can you really separate the dancer from the dance? Nancy Umanoff of the Mark Morris Dance Group shares the dance world's shock at the news about Cunningham's company.
This two-year tour that they're doing right now is the last chance that anybody will get to see Merce's dances on the dancers that he trained. Sort of, you know, it's the essence of what makes the work great on that company. Lots of companies can do Merce's work, but it's not quite the same. And that's why it's so important to see the work now, to see it the way that Merce intended it on the bodies that he trained. And so, you know, the question is, can the work stand up when it loses that? That's, I think, a big question that a lot of choreographers deal with when they make a decision about whether their work will live beyond them.
After an international tour, the last performance of the Merce Cunningham Dance Company will be on New Year's Eve next year, 2011. This legacy plan had Merce's blessing. He'd said he wanted his work to last in some way, but wouldn't say how. So his staff consulted widely. He'd started the company so he could create, experiment, and perform. That wouldn't be relevant when he died. He should, the advice came back, plan to shut his company and license his works to other dance groups.
The days of having a full company of 15 dancers and being able to maintain them throughout the year is definitely over. I mean, I've given up trying to hold on to that idea. You can understand, this certainly is not my ideal, but I've had to accept it and try to do the best I can with it.
It's just that there's this strange picture that I have in a few years that it will be possible to see these fantastic works danced not by you, mm-hmm. but
well,
danced
we'll
by
be
other
responsible
people.
Responsible for staging those pieces, for sure. But, yes, we won't be able to do that. Unless, of course, somebody comes to us and says, well, we'd like you to organize a group to do this dance and take a tour. I mean, that's always a possibility, too. What do they call them? Revival. You know how these rock bands get together and do those things? Well, I mean, right now, I'm just worried about holding on to the studio, to tell you the truth.
How difficult is that? How much is that?
Well, it's expensive. Let's just speak in those terms.
In Germany, money hasn't forced the issue. The city of Wuppertal has committed for now to fund the Tanztheater at the same level as before Pina died, and three-year contracts had anyway just been signed. In America, though, it's mostly making new work that brings in the money. Trevor Carlson is the executive director of the Cunningham Foundation.
The question about a dance company that does not produce new work, an organization that exists in a single artist's name, with the knowledge, and we had this knowledge, Merce was quite clear about this, he wasn't interested in having other choreographers work on his dance company. So with all of those things in place, and the knowledge that a great amount of support that the company receives is garnered through the creation of new work. So we would lose that avenue. You become a touring museum of dance.
Things can go wrong when a company tries to exist on the personality and vision of one dead dance maker. Martha Graham was perhaps the most high profile of contemporary dance pioneers in America. She died in 1991. This summer, I saw her company perform political solos made by Graham and her contemporaries during the 1930s. The programme was called Dance is a Weapon. The solos were authentic, interesting, worthwhile, and the dancers committed. But there's a difference in style between preservation and revival. And I was surprised by their loss of confidence in the audience. The material was presented with voiceover and film archive and introduced like a lecture demonstration. Jacqueline Bulness dances with the company.
They're trying to bring a different audience, or even trying to educate the audience on Martha Graham and what she was trying to say in her work. Because unfortunately, nobody really knows about Martha Graham, not many people. We teach them. I guess we're really trying to survive without money and with an audience that has no idea what we're putting out there. It's really sad because the audience members, they'll say, hey, I've never seen this before. I had no idea. Who is Martha Graham?
Who is Martha Graham? She made a whole new physical language for the passions called contemporary dance.
The only way for me to dance is if it means something, if it's emotional. And this work is so powerful in so many ways. My fourth year of high school, my senior year of high school, was a very difficult year for me. My mother passed away, and I found the power in the movement expressed the pain that I was feeling.
What about seeing her work performed? Can you remember when you first saw it performed, perhaps by the company?
I was just blown away. I mean, I got chills. I'm getting chills right now just thinking about the moment, but they did not lose their focus for a second.
Had any other companies had that effect on you, or any other choreography?
Pina Bausch. I always did want to dance for Pina Bausch, you know.
There was a battle between the administration and the dancers after Martha Graham's death that had a serious impact on the survival of her dance works. The company closed while the ownership of the dancers was debated. The courts wrested them back for the company. Disputes about how a dance is best served by its inheritors can bog a dance down. George Balanchine's will divided his ballets up between 13 or 14 legatees, splitting the rights three ways: American rights to one legatee, foreign to another, media to another. When he died in 1983, Barbara Horgan, his former PA, inherited one-third of the rights to 75 of his ballets.
It was a menu for disaster. I was extraordinarily fortunate in having a very close friend who was a lawyer. His name is Paul Epstein, and that name should be in the mind and on the lips of every choreographer, because he put together this idea of a trust. And there were three heirs who had the most intellectual properties. And we decided to put our rights into this trust and then go to the other heirs and ask them if they would like to put their rights into trust. Anybody who went into the trust had complete authority on their ballets. They could say yes, they could say no. But if they said yes, and the trust licensed that ballet on their behalf, they would receive the income immediately. So the legacy just sort of fell into place. And the other thing about legacy is supply and demand. People wanted his ballets.
Merce Cunningham, paying attention to these precedents, formed his own trust, which now owns and licenses his dance works. But when you hire a dance, what do you hire? The Cunningham Company are making dance capsules, online memory boxes for 50 of Merce's 200 works. Notice 3/4 of his dancers will have gone just like that. When a new company hires a work, a stager, an experienced Cunningham dancer, will reconstruct the dance with the help of the material in the capsules. Patricia Lent is in charge of licensing the dancers.
The key issue is, do we have any kind of video record? Without a videotape where we can see the dance, it's very, very difficult to imagine bringing it back. Merce's notes are extremely useful and extremely rich. Often in his dances, he would start off with a certain number of phrases, typically 64, that number coming from the I Ching, and he would make 64 phrases, and there would be a notebook that had the 64 phrases immediately for a stager. That is probably the most useful. That tells you what Merce walked into the studio intending to say to the dancers. Then there's also notebooks that have his plan for the structure of the dance. And that's where there are echoes of how he used chance procedures. So, for example, presumably using chance, he's figured out that phrase number 23 and 17 and 1 will be in section 1. There's also notebooks that are clearly the notebook that he carried into rehearsal over the course of the weeks of working with the dancer. So you can see timings, changing an entrance or changing an exit, who's doing which phrases. But in and of themselves, it's difficult to reconstruct a dance purely from the notes. The way that I think of it is that the notes are, in a sense, the plan for the dance, and the videotape is a record of what happened. I've always thought that the videotape that I would most like to have, it's not the rehearsal tape that's made the moment the dance is done. If it could exist, it would be a performance tape from a year later with the original cast. Because as you grow into the dance and learn to put it on stage, certain adjustments have to be made and you grow into the movement. So that would be the videotape that I would most like to have.
If it's on video, how can we call a dance ephemeral? Well, apart from the fact that video disintegrates after 20 years unless tenderly attended to, each video is partial. It shows just one version of the dance and we don't know which one. In Wuppertal, the Bausch performers try to overcome this by running films of up to 4 different performances on VT machines around the rehearsal hall. But which is it? At the Cunningham Studios, Robert Swinston is reviving Merce's Pondway with Cunningham dancers. He's just taught them a jump which has contrarily hard arm and leg combinations. The difficulty is what these dancers are laughing at and struggling with. So they look at the original cast in rehearsal on a 1997 videotape. But what good is that? Should they be copying the way most of the dancers, one by one, don't do the almost impossible jump? Should they presume they had permission not to try? Or should these dancers now all try to do it the way the final man on the video does, and beautifully?
Yeah, that person did it. Tom Cayley did it. I'm doing it.
The tape's almost meaningless without the memory of someone who was there.
What's very useful in approaching a dance, if you have been in it, is not necessarily that you remember every step, but you have a sense of how the dance worked, whether rhythm was particularly important at that time, whether Merce was talking about falling a lot at that time, whether the dance had a warmer feeling. It felt like you were more alone in the space.
If the choreographer was there with them today, he or she might decide to change it.
Do you want us to do that sidearm, Robert? Because we were doing this, but they're doing that.
Okay, yeah, do that.
Because keeping a dance alive is a continual process.
Turn the arm out.
They're doing that.
Okay, so let's clarify this.
Can process continue? Tal Tanz Theatre, Pina revived pieces every year. She recast the roles. Not all new casts had the same combination of gifts as the originals, so she would then split the roles themselves apart to give one scene to one dancer, another to another, according to their skills, to keep all the dance work at its original pitch. But what the dancers could take from the creator is harder for her deputies. Dominique Mercy.
It's not easy because we have to cope with different personality and sensitivity from each dancer, which Pina had to do, but she was Pina. But I wanted to say, I feel free to do those things because through the responsibility we have, that the piece looks fidèle. Do you speak any French?
No. Faithful.
True. Yeah, true. Mm. Yes.
I imagine that Pina, because she's the creator, had some extra right to drag extremes of sort of commitment and physicality and emotion out of people, that people will allow that to happen because she's making something. But does that become much harder to, you know, wrench people to that edge?
No, because there's from each dancer from the company an increasing of responsibility about the work and about themselves.
Is that very much because you're all people who were touched by her and very directly?
Of course.
But could you foresee handing that on to another generation of dancers?
I don't know. The range of age is so big within the company that logically, there will be some need of new members on one way or the other. And that will happen, that people will have to dance pieces without having been contacted or seen or heard Pina, which makes, of course, a big difference. But I can't tell.
The Cunningham Company has some experience of handing works to dancers who haven't known Merce, although never so entirely as now.
That's the right idea. Keep moving. Look back, and then step and go back again. That's the right idea.
Yeah. Jeannie Steele staged Rainforest on Rombert Dance Company this spring. It was the first time the 1968 work has been danced by dancers other than the Cunningham Company.
Somehow the drop is losing its momentum. Yeah? So you need to go sharper, I think. Go and drop, go. And he changes arms, and go up, and now turn and grab and drop and run, and turn and grab and drop. That's a little, okay, so something in between.
Of course the dance will look different on them.
I was in the company for almost 12 and a half years, and I was an apprentice for 3 years before that. And I got to see a lot of different people do a lot of different roles, and he never once said, look, I made this for a particular person and I need you to do it like this, like they did it. We were allowed to inhabit it.
Because that's something I really noticed. That was the thing I was most surprised about watching the rehearsal, was the difference in the way that the second cast, the cast that I saw second, were dancing, made me at first not even recognise that I was seeing the same material again. So the dance can admit this massive difference in effect, and yet you would then pay acute attention to a really particular detail, like an angle in a leg. Mm-hmm. Is there a way of describing which difference is right?
This is the thing. I really don't feel that there is a right or wrong. I don't think that Merce ever thought, oh, this is right or this is wrong. It's more about an energy. Tamed, solitary beings who meet in strange, sensual, inexplicable, mysterious, sometimes hostile encounters and part, much as animals might do in the wild.
Jeannie read Mercer's words about Rainforest to all three casts.
Hostile?
Sometimes hostile. Mm-hmm. There are moments. Mm-hmm. There are moments of hostility. Yeah, you're kind of the hostile one.
I like that. So there's one word I really like.
Untamed.
I really like that
word. No, but I think that that's a really untamed. Good, that's a good word yeah. for us.
For instance, there's a solo that was made for Carolyn Brown originally. The Hellcat solo, I think she called it. She was this fierce animal beast who came running out and sort of had her way with one of the other characters and then stayed on and did this very fierce solo where she's slapping her thighs and, you know, all this very aggressive movement with fists in the air. And, you know, each dancer does the movement completely differently, but they all were able to unleash that fearsome energy. And so that's how I chose. And they also were all three able to find a stillness against that ferocity.
But at the same time, you are having to pay attention to the steps.
Oh, sure, sure. Unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, I don't know. You know, this piece was done in 1968, it was done in 1988, it was done again in 1994. That was my first time doing it. And then we did it again in 2003. And each time, it shifted. I mean, some of the steps from the beginning are completely changed because Merce had dancers that could do more. So he recreated many steps. The essence of the step is the same, but the physical difficulty, it increased dramatically from 1968 to 2004.
That's better. That's a little better. Go, yes, yes. Right. Yeah, I like that better.
He created that possibility for us to let the dance change and to let new people explore it in a way that suits them. I do believe that it can live. It's going to live differently, obviously, because he's not here and we can't refer or defer to him anymore and say, well, is it this or do you want that? But at the same time, he left us this beautiful palette of movement and said, you know, you can put this color here and that color here, or you can change your mind.
Who will want to license the work for how long? The New York Times dance critic Alistair McCauley is a long-term admirer of Cunningham, and just back from being thrilled in Los Angeles by Patricia Lent's revival of Roratorio with a score by John Cage.
Just from watching the man. It breaks my heart, but with Cunningham, I generally expect to see almost none of his choreography 10 years from now. Much of Cunningham's work was itself tentative, exploratory. You could always see on stage Cunningham was sort of saying, is this a dance? What if I did this? Giving you an odd movement that he'd never tried before. And quite often proving that it was part of a dance, but making you see the difficulty. Now, when that's done without music to make it appealing, that's tough. Who else is going to stage Roratorio with a controversial score that needs particular dance executants, people who understand the spirit of that work? I think most dance companies just don't have the time getting into work and then possibly alienating the audience at the end of it.
The companies most ravenous for new work and able to afford it are repertory ballet companies. The fear is that ballet institutions have a house style that aggrandizes and alters the new work. Ballet technique has a value system, framing the body and the face for the audience, which, for example, Cunningham technique does not.
How difficult is it then to give one of these dances to people who may not have a history of working their body that way?
Well, that's always the challenge. And I think that, you know, in the simplest way of thinking about Merce's technique, it's a combination of a lot of legwork from classical technique, which is then kind of analyzed and deconstructed in some way, and then a lot of torso work from modern dance, and then a little tap dancing, a little vaudeville. So rather than thinking about what a particular group of dancers, where their weaknesses are, to look at where their strengths are. So, for example, a ballet company is going to have typically quite strong legwork. So then the trick is to attach
to that legwork, a better understanding of how the torso works. If you're working with a contemporary company, they may have a nice sense of flow and weight, but be less articulate with their legs. I think that the difficulty sometimes is when some of the movements from a piece of Merce's look enough like something that another dancer has done in another kind of work that they flip it right over. Merce might say, you know, put your leg to the front and bend it. So that's an attitude. But an attitude has a certain relationship between the torso and the arms and the leg and the audience and a proscenium stage that make them recognizable as classical ballet, which is not part of put your leg to the front and bend it. With a lot of the modern work that's contemporary work that's done now has this sort of sense of release, and so people see a curve and they want to kind of swoop into it. There isn't a lot of swooping in Merce's work. So the curve is more, it's an activity and it's a powerful shape, and it's both of those things at once working against each other, but it's not swoopy. If we go into a project with the goal that the dance is going to look exactly like it would look if the Merce Cunningham Dance Company performed it, we're setting ourselves up for disappointment. We are going to come up with a dance.
That's fine for the dancers. What about the audience? Is a diminished dance really better than no dance? Because some people might argue that the dance is in the detail, and nowhere more so than in ballet watching. Alistair McCauley.
I'll give you a simple example. One of the ballets that is brought round most often by Frederick Ashton is A Month in the Country. If you saw it in the first 2 years, the first section ends in a kind of mazurka where four of the dancers just come forward flicking their hands, going one, two, three, four, rising. And they caught as they turn their hands, cupping their hands in the air and twisting them. One, two, three, four. I don't know quite how they hit the beat, whether they anticipated the beat, what it was. Something that Ashton taught them, that at every performance, when that ballet was just alive in its first 2 years, people would come out repeating those little hand movements in the audience. They just loved them. You could feel a tizzy, a kinesthetic tizzy, right throughout the audience. That kind of thing's typical of Ashton's ballets. After those first 2 years, that had gone. But that's just one example of how a step is never quite there again. That sense of nostalgia once you saw the original cast, that's so typical of dance.
Yes, I was going to say, do you think that part of loving dance is being in love with that romance of loss?
Not quite. But I think dance is so much about the moment and about memory. When you leave the theatre, you then realise you're in love with that moment when they were flicking their hands in Month of the Country. And that gets into your memory, and you'll find you're disturbed, thrilled by it the next day and the day after that. And when you go back to see another cast, you say, oh, it's not quite the same with this cast. And you start to understand better what the first cast did. It's not that this cast is necessarily better. Of course, two casts can bring out different things. But generally, the original cast is going to make you live in the moment more intensely than any other.
And do you trust your memory?
You question your memory the whole time. Dance makes such a strong impression on you that memory just becomes an important part of the experience. Dancers normally have very good muscle or eye memories when it comes to movement. Generally, non-dancers don't. For some reason, I've got a good memory for movement. And so when Balanchine's Serenade ends, I'll go round to a friend saying, surely now she's ending with her arms in that position with the hands apart. Didn't she used to end leaning sideways with her hands together in what we call an encoron or fifth position? Maybe another friend with a good memory would say, yes, you know, but I think that was peculiar to the 1970s. And Balanchine himself changed it at the end of his life. It's kind of pedantic, but it matters.
Does the phenomenal survival of Balanchine ballets, especially since his death in 1983, have something to teach modern dance, apart from just business nows? Barbara Horgan is managing trustee of the Balanchine Trust.
The Israeli ballet that was just started came to New York, and they had a performance at Carnegie Hall, and they did Serenade with recorded music. These poor girls could hardly get up on point. And you know, they pulled it off, and I realized it's indestructible. I could probably get up and dance it myself, and nobody would know the difference because it's structured so well.
The composer John Cage wrote an essay in 1944 which tried to deduce why classical ballet survives when most modern dance doesn't. That is, though most ballets die, ballet itself lives on. He attributed its longevity to two qualities, grace and clarity. By clarity, he meant rhythmic structure, cold, inhuman, earthy, structured time. And grace, he wrote, is warm, incalculable, human, opposed to clarity and like the air. Grace is the soul to clarity's body. The two are endlessly and life-givingly opposed to each other. A living modern dance maker whose work has grace and clarity is Mark Morris. Like Balanchine, his time structure is musical and he plays. He's only 53, but since the deaths of Bausch and Cunningham, legacy is being discussed throughout the dance world. They performed his dance to Handel's L'Allegro, Il Penseroso ed Il Moderato in Birmingham this year. That's where I asked his executive director, Nancy Umanoff, about their plans for his dancers.
Well, the first question is, should they survive? Mark has not made a definitive decision about that. When he was younger, he felt like, you know, when I'm gone, it's over. The dancers won't live on beyond me. I think that's starting to change. I think it's changed a little bit after his mother passed away. He set up a memorial fund to raise money so that our classes at the school could remain affordable. What Mark's mother gave to him was the opportunity to become the very thing he wanted. When Mark was 8 or 9, he saw a flamenco show and said, that's what I want to do. And his mom got him classes and started him on his career and was supportive throughout her life. Once she was gone, that translated for him to try to create that opportunity for other people. But there, as I said, there are no definitive decisions about what will happen about those dances yet. I don't know. We'll see what he decides.
We might lose then. The Mark Morris dance group, Mark Morris dancers. Mm-hmm. And actually makes me feel quite shaky.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I think that watching these last few nights, watching L'Allegro every night, I think, how dare we deprive the future of this magnificent piece of art? But in some ways, it's not my decision. All of Mark's works are copyrighted. They're all recorded. They're in the Library of Congress in the United States. They're in archives all over the world. So they will be viewed, or, you know, one performance recording of these pieces will be viewed. But I don't know that Mark feels that those pieces need to live on. The ephemeral nature of dance is one of the things that is so thrilling about being in the theater with a live orchestra, live dancers, live audiences, and then it's gone.
Perhaps we should go to see dancers like we go and see a person we love, whose time we know is short. Now, soon, or never. Merce Cunningham wrote that his dancing teacher, Mrs. Barrett, showed him that dance is most deeply concerned with each single instant as it comes along, and its life and vigour and attraction lie in just that singleness. It is as accurate and impermanent as breathing. Dominic Mercy in Wuppertal Tanztheater wonders about the future.
What we don't decide it and really know yet, it's how and when we're going to make something new. And we know, it's important. It's a very important source of life for a company to continue to be creative, to be confronted to this fever and whatever to step forward. We don't know yet how we're going to solve this. The idea is not to put a choreographer in place of Pina. And it's, yeah. That's for the moment, it's not the idea anyway.
I've been asking people what they would hate to lose.
I think it would be Symphony in Three Movements. When he did it in 1972, it was like nothing he had ever done.
I would take this Brecht Weil evening, the Seven Deadly Sins.
You know, the finale in L'Allegro. There's one moment that...
Singing, acting, crying, laughing, hysterical...
Dancers coming downstage, running towards you, wave after wave, and giant leaps across the stage. And then for the first time, they come at each other.
You see dancing, you see everything in this evening.
It's incredibly joyous and exactly the thing that should happen.
After Dance Makers Die was presented and produced by Francis Burns and is a Rocket House production. The Merce Cunningham Dance Company makes its final visit to the Barbican in London this October, and Pina Bausch's works will be performed in a large celebration at that theatre and Sadler's Wells in 2012. Well, our next programme this evening at 10:45 is the essay in which Ashutosh Khandelwal talks about his lifelong love of opera. Till then, let's hear some ballet music by Aaron Copland. His Rodeo was commissioned by the Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo. Its premiere was in 1942, with choreography by Agnes de Mille. There are four dance episodes from the ballet, and we have time for three. Here are Choral Nocturne, Saturday Night Waltz, and Hoedown. 3 of Aaron Copland's dance episodes from the ballet Rodeo, Choral Nocturne, Saturday Night Waltz and Hoedown. They were played by the English Symphony Orchestra, conducted by William Boughton. Well, here we are in the second week of the proms, and the season contains words as well as music. Here's Ian McMillan to explain.
The proms is, as we know, the world's greatest festival of music, stretching from now to September like a note that's held and held and held. And I reckon the proms poetry competition is one of the world's greatest poetry competitions, stretching your imagination from now to the closing date of August the 6th. What we'd like to do is write a poem in any style on a piece of music that's performed at this year's proms. You can react to the music in all sorts of ways. It could evoke a memory. It could make you feel something abstract and profound. Or you could pen a sonnet on the way the conductor moves on the podium in the same way your Auntie Mabel moved as she hung out her washing. There are three age groups, 7 to 11, 11 to 18 and 18 upwards. I'm the judge, along with the former Children's Laureate Michael Rosen, and I can't wait to read your entries.
Ian McMillan. This is Radio 3, it's a quarter to 11, and time for the third in this week's series of The Essay. Tonight, Ashutosh Khandekar, who's the editor-in-chief of Opera Now magazine, recounts how his childhood in Bombay and student days in Britain led to a lifelong love of opera.
I'm lucky enough to come from a culture where singing comes as naturally to people as eating and drinking. Evenings with family and friends at home in Bombay would invariably end in singing games, rounds of nostalgic tunes from old Bollywood with tales of matinee idols, heroes and villains, punctuated by songs that were energetic, wistful and plangent according to the twists and turns of the drama. No wonder I ended up falling in love with opera. As editor of an opera magazine, it's my job to see sometimes 4-5 operas in a week. Nice work if you can get it, some of you might think, though it doesn't always seem like it when you're stuck in a traffic jam on the M23, battling through the cold and wet of an English summer, on the way to the opening night of Glyndebourne, or delayed in an airport en route back from the first night of Turandot in Bishkek. It's easy enough to become jaded, and I think many critics are. It goes with the territory of seeing too many mediocre, hastily conceived productions. But at its best, there's nothing like opera. Once the house lights are down and the curtain rises, the thrill is always there. Ahead of you lies a compendium of human foibles, etched in the razor-sharp wit of Mozart, the hyperreal grandeur of Verdi, the saturated emotional turmoil of Puccini, and the wistful arch-tenderness of Richard Strauss. I think it was this hyper-reality that first attracted me to opera as a teenager, looking for ways to assert a nascent adult personality on an unsuspecting world. By now, sent to boarding school in England, I may have been useless on the rugby pitch, but I had a tenor voice, it was loud, and it seemed to make an impression of some kind whenever and wherever it was deployed. My top B-flat, well, it might have scared the neighbour's cat, but if you've got it, flaunt it, was my philosophy. Nessun dorma, here I come. My piano teacher, exhausted and exasperated by my lack of application to scales and arpeggios, finally gave in and tried me out on a dog-eared book of aria antica. Caro mio ben, I bellowed, a little too lustily, overjoyed that the emotional maelstrom of my adolescence had finally found a channel through which it could express itself. It was that same piano teacher, Mary Hamilton, who astonished me when she sang soprano solo in the School Choral Society's performance of the Verdi Requiem. It was the first time that I saw with my own eyes the transformational powers of music. A petite, no-nonsense Glaswegian who had trained as a singer at the Royal Scottish Academy, Mary took on a totally unexpected hugeness, a true nobility from the moment she launched herself into Verdi's soaring Kyrie. I was gripped right up to the dying cadences of the Liberame. Many years later, this music from my boyhood still echoed in my memory and gave me the key to understanding when I heard my first riveting Don Carlo at Covent Garden. It isn't natural, a school friend once pointed out, at the height of a heated debate about which was better, opera or football. He was referring to opera, of course, though he failed to explain what was so natural about kicking a ball from one end of a large field to the other. I was about 14 at the time, at the end of an afternoon when I could have been running around in the early spring sunshine, taking in lungfuls of fresh air. Instead, I'd spent a precious hour and a half in a dingy, overheated music practice room, putting the finishing touches to my rendition of Marco in the end-of-term production of The Gondoliers. Looking back, those rough-and-ready school productions of Gilbert and Sullivan served the same purpose in my developing taste for opera as Latin did in helping my grasp of French vocab and grammar. They laid the foundations. All right, it's musical fluff, not to be taken seriously, I know. But Sullivan's marvellously skilful pastiches of grand opera captured the essence of the thing perfectly. Mabel's show-stoppingly florid entrance in The Pirates of Penzance, Iolanthe's pitifully touching plea for her life amid all the brassy political clamour of the Houses of Parliament, Yum Yum's ravishing, radiant hymn to the sun and the moon, and to her own vanity. And most of all, Marco, the hopelessly romantic gondolier, staring lovingly into a pair of sparkling eyes.